playbook that once held men accountable has been tossed. A world where educated girls are sent off to college to become sex toys for men, used and cast aside. You have to pull back the curtain. Playboy feminism. You have to get back to where it all began. A very good starting point is with a prominent cultural figure who literally turned women into profitable playthings for men and called it empowering, a self-professed feminist who praises the sexual revolution and touts his own role in it. Hugh Hefner. In an interview for Esquire, the founder of the Playboy Enterprise said of the sexual revolution, "Women were the major beneficiary of the sexual revolution. It permitted them to be natural sexual beings, as men are. That's where feminism should have been all along. Unfortunately, within feminism, there has been a Puritan, prohibitionist element that is anti-sexual. Playboy is the antidote to Puritanism. In the 1950s and 60s, there were still states that outlawed birth control, so I started funding court cases to challenge that. At the same time, I helped sponsor the lower court cases that eventually led to Roe v. Wade. We were the amicus curiae in Roe v. Wade. I was a feminist before there was such a thing as feminism. That's a part of history very few people know." The common thinking is that the sexual revolution was primarily about liberating women from the constraints of traditional sexual morality, whose double standard discriminated against them. Second wave feminists in the 1960s and 70s believed that once women were freed from the puritanical rules and taboos that repressed their sexual expression, they could enjoy sex just the way men do. Women only needed to be freed from oppressive expectations and institutions like modesty, chastity, and marriage, liberated from their body's fecundity, and released into a world where they could have sex on the same terms as men. In the words of Hugh Hefner, hardly a feminist by anyone's definition, it permitted them to be natural sexual beings, as men are. Except women aren't exactly like men. They're particularly unlike the kind of men whose sexuality seemed natural to Hugh Hefner, carefree libertines and heartless lechers. The ideology that there are no significant differences between the sexes, which eventually became known as gender equity, gave birth to the pantsuit, the pill, and Planned Parenthood. All three had the effect of making women more like men, the stubborn, paradigmatic ideal of the era. As Harvey Mansfield put it, gender neutrality seems at first to disregard sexual differences, but it also wants women to be more independent, more like men. It assumes that what was until recently specific to men is actually common to both sexes. And yet, there are elements of masculinity and femininity that don't overlap. As Mansfield puts it, there remains an obstacle to gender neutrality, manliness, which does not seem easily removable, even in time. He points out the truth that many of today's feminists still won't look straight in the eye. Men reject and resist the expectation that they should abandon their manliness. Women, on the other hand, abandoned a great portion of their femaleness in the sexual revolution in a mostly doomed attempt to establish equality, understood as being identical, with men. The sexual revolution was premised on the long overdue empowerment of one sex, but it had the effect of erasing most of the distinctions that set it apart from the other. Femaleness was absorbed into maleness, and as female difference, a powerful check on the worst qualities of maleness has been wiped out, women have gotten the short end of the stick. We've gotten a world where we are expected to perform emotionally, professionally, physically, and sexually just like men. The sexual revolution, billed as progress for women, is actually just a Ponzi scheme for the patriarchy. When my generation of women comes to cash in on its promises, we're finding it bankrupt. Pay any price, bear any burden. A 2016 article in Cosmopolitan magazine excitedly announced that reversible condomless birth control for men is finally on the horizon and might be ready as soon as 2018. This could be the answer to your male birth control prayers, the author breathlessly exclaimed. The woman who heads the organization trying to develop the male birth control, in what read like a desperate attempt to preempt men's horror at the thought of injecting a gel into their ball sack, with which then block sperm from leaving the vas deferens, is quoted as saying, "There are so many men who want this so badly. The support is going to be there." An equally fevered headline in the Telegraph read, "The male pill is coming, and it's going to change everything." In fact, birth control options for men, including the exact injections described in the Cosmo piece, have been a viable option for decades. Trials on the drug found that it worked with almost perfect results and no serious side effects. The problem? Men don't actually want it. Contraceptive injections for men were developed and patented nearly four decades ago, in the 1970s, and yet Arikia Milliken argues for Vice that the time for reliable male birth control is long overdue because, in present-day 2015, the available options aren't great, and the burden still rests largely on women to mitigate the damages of our wanton impulses. Aside from the copper IUD, all the birth control devices and pharmaceuticals available to women alter our hormones with various weird side effects. She is far from alone in expressing frustration that it is the women who wound up responsible for controlling their reproductive functions, despite all the talk about sexual equality and freedom. There seems to be a major delay in developing artificial birth control for men that is as relatively convenient and effective as what's on the market for women. As one female writer sarcastically put it, the male birth control pill is still right around the corner, like it has been for years. Try decades, but that's basically accurate. WebMD will tell you there are plenty of drugs that have been in the pipeline that could disarm male fertility, much as the pill alters ovulation and fertility in women. The problem, just about every article on male birth control argues, is funding. Despite the fact that the multi-billion-dollar pharmaceutical industry is one of the biggest drivers of the economy, apparently there is no funding for male birth control. And not much interest. In 2016, excitement grew around the latest experiment in male birth control, but then men dropped out because they experienced side effects affecting their mood, libido, and skin pretty similar to what women have suffered while taking the pill for years. "It takes two to tango," explained an article in Quartz, "but the burden of birth control falls largely on women." It couldn't possibly be that men don't want to give up an essential part of what makes them men, their fertility. Chemical birth control for men is branded as something that would give them control over their fertility, pretty much the same way the pill was sold to women. In reality, it would be the ultimate surrender of something essential to who they are, the ultimate surrender of control. Somehow, in the wake of the sexual revolution, men have been able to see this and to resist it, while women have not. So nearly six decades after the FDA approved the pill as a contraceptive, women are still the ones stuck shutting down their fertility, suffering all the unwanted side effects, and, of course, dealing with the ramifications when birth control fails. This shouldn't come as a surprise. From the get-go, the sexual revolution's plan for eliminating the double standard was not really to liberate women to be women. It was to make the female body just like the male body, barren. In 1967, the National Organization for Women, a group funded by one of the revolution's lady generals, Betty Friedan, inserted the right of women to control their own reproductive lives into its Bill of Rights for Women. The notion that female fertility was the problem underlying gender inequality pervaded the sexual revolution. Margaret Sanger, godmother of the pill and founder of Planned Parenthood, defended the disproportionate burden of birth control on women, calling it, first of all, a woman's problem. Many people who believe in birth control as the means of voluntary motherhood say that the propaganda of the movement is directed too much to women and too little to men. They contend that the appeal should be to men quite as much as to women, and that a strong effort should be made to arouse the masculine half of humanity to its responsibilities in relation to the evils growing out of the enslavement of the reproductive function. It is true that the propaganda of the birth control movement in America has been addressed almost entirely to women. It has been couched in the terms of woman's experience. Its prime importance to her has been continuously and consistently stressed. The reason for this course is at once fundamental and practical. A free race cannot be born of slave mothers. A woman enchained cannot choose but give a measure of bondage to her sons and daughters. No woman can call herself free who does not own and control her body. No woman can call herself free until she can choose consciously whether she will or will not be a mother. Birth control is a woman's problem. The quicker she accepts it as hers and hers alone, the quicker will society respect motherhood. The quicker, too, will the world be made a fit place for children to live. But the actual result was just the opposite. Birth control became a woman's problem, all right, but respect for motherhood plummeted. The ultimate fix. The most obvious proof of this was, concurrent with the popular acceptance of birth control, the rise of abortion, which is the ultimate fix when the pill and other contraceptives fail to make a woman's body work just like a man's. Whereas early feminists were ardently opposed to abortion, viewing it as an assault on the female body, the second-wave feminists of the sexual revolution made a major break with that thinking, arguing that full female freedom would only be attainable if abortion were made legal. First-wave feminists saw abortion as exploitative of women. Suffragette and abolitionist Elizabeth Cady Stanton said of abortion, "When we consider that women are treated as property, it is degrading to women that we should treat our children as property to be disposed of as we see fit." The first woman to run for president, Victoria Woodhull, wrote, "Every woman knows that if she were free, she would never bear an unwished-for child, nor think of murdering one before its birth." And Elizabeth Blackwell, the first woman to get a medical degree, called abortion the gross perversion and destruction of motherhood, and said that it filled me with indignation and awakened active antagonism. These early activists for equality believed that women's rights could not be built on the rejection of an essential part of woman, her capacity for motherhood. Abortion is the ultimate rejection of motherhood, and in effect, a rejection of woman herself, including her body. The sexual revolution saw a 180-degree pivot away from this appreciation for motherhood and the female body. Suddenly, female fertility was a problem that had to be eradicated in order for women to achieve full equality with men. Gloria Steinem, godmother of the sexual revolution, famously asserted that society treats women as mere talking wombs. In an interview with The Guardian, she said, "It took us a while to figure it out, but patriarchy, or whatever you want to call it, the systems that say there's masculine and feminine and other expletive, is about controlling reproduction. Every economics course ought to start not with production, but with reproduction. It is way more important." Steinem is famous for her maxim, "If men could get pregnant, abortion would be a sacrament." She dedicated her recent book to a man who helped her secure an illegal abortion when she was 22, something he did on the condition, "You will do what you want to do with your life." The perception driving much of the sexual revolution was that that was exactly what men did. They did whatever they wanted with their lives, including sexually, and a woman's only ticket to the same freedom was legal abortion. To the revolutionaries of the day, sexual difference was the source of inequality between men and women. Giving women control over their reproductive functions, at whatever moral cost, was feminists' top priority in the sexual revolution. Somewhere, Hugh Hefner was smiling, and so was writer and pro-abortion activist Lauren Slater. While working on a biography of Planned Parenthood foundress Margaret Sanger, Slater had become an ardent proponent of abortion, gathering a group of like-minded activists in his Manhattan apartment to form what eventually became known as NARAL, a lobbying group devoted to the repeal of state abortion laws. of Sanger, later told the New York Times that working on Sanger completely convinced me that a woman's freedom in education, jobs, marriage, her whole life, could only be achieved when she gained control of her childbearing. Of abortion opponents, he said, basically, the opposition really hates women, which I think comes out of a woman's sexuality. One of Later's fellow NARAL founders, Dr. Bernard Nathanson, was an abortionist looking to expand and legitimize his business. Nathanson, who later in life changed his position, becoming an outspoken opponent of abortion, said that Later once told him, "If we're going to move abortion out of the books and into the streets, we're going to have to recruit the feminists." Later explicitly referred to another matriarch of the revolution, Betty Friedan, saying, "Friedan has got to put her troops into this thing, while she still has control over them." Although Friedan had not even mentioned abortion in the first edition of The Feminine Mystique, the infamous 1963 tome widely credited with launching the second wave feminism integral to the sexual revolution, Later and Nathanson succeeded in making her their mouthpiece for abortion as a right. In a speech she delivered at the First National Conference for Repeal of Abortion Laws in Chicago in 1969, Friedan argued, "The basic personhood and dignity of woman is violated forever if she does not have the right to control her own reproductive process." To Friedan, "The right of woman to control her reproductive process must be established as a basic, inalienable civil right, not to be denied or abridged by the state." Nearly every women's rights advocate who followed in her wake made the same claims, and freedom and equality for women became inextricably intertwined with abortion. A woman's place. But the rejection of woman did not end with her perceived bodily imperfections. It was not just that women's rights became synonymous with the right to end maternity through the violent invasion of the womb. The sexual revolution also witnessed a devaluation of motherhood and home life that came in tandem with the demand for greater opportunities for women in the workforce. Betty Friedan's feminine mystique was central to this change. She had likened unhappy housewives to walking corpses living in comfortable concentration camps in the book. Friedan based a good deal of her writing on that of Margaret Mead, an anthropologist who studied tribal cultures. Because some tribes had less pronounced cultural differences between the sexes, Mead concluded that, in Friedan's words, there are an infinite variety of sexual patterns and an enormous plasticity to human nature. Friedan called Mead's work a truly revolutionary vision of women finally free to realize their full capabilities in a society which replaced arbitrary sexual definitions with a recognition of genuine individual gifts as they occur in either sex. Mead pivoted later in life toward a more Freudian approach that acknowledged distinct and mysterious differences between the sexes, not attributable to random cultural influences, but Friedan dismissed her later work, saying that Mead cut down her own vision of women by glorifying the mysterious miracle of femininity. Looking back, it would seem that the principal project of the sexual revolution was to wipe out that mysterious miracle under the mantle of ending oppression. To the warriors of the sexual revolution, women were only really living if they lived like men. The leaders of the sexual revolution went beyond demanding that women have access to the same professional and educational opportunities as men. They outright rejected the notion that domestic work and raising children were acceptable ways for a liberated, modern, and empowered woman to spend her life. When Friedan dared to suggest to another revolutionary, Simone de Beauvoir, that women ought to at least have the choice as to whether or not to stay home and raise children, de Beauvoir replied, "No, we don't believe that any woman should have this choice. No woman should be authorized to stay at home to raise her children. Society should be totally different. Women should not have that choice, precisely because if there is such a choice, too many women will make that one." Sounds extreme, and yet decades later, in 2011, when The Economist held an online Oxford-style debate and poll on the statement, "This House believes that a woman's place is at work," nearly half of respondents agreed with the statement. The year before, Reuters had done its own survey, asking the opposite question, whether a woman's place is in the home. 74% disagreed. While the very idea that women have any one place where they belong would seem to be unnecessarily constricting, the litany of articles about female angst over feeling torn between their careers and their children and home makes it clear that the sexual revolution's devaluation of motherhood and domesticity thoroughly pervades modern culture. Sex and the law. The sexual revolution upended centuries of policies built around sexual norms. Not all the changes were bad. Thanks to a series of hard-fought legal challenges, women were afforded educational and employment opportunities they had previously been denied. The year The Feminine Mystique was published, for instance, President Kennedy signed the Equal Pay Act to remedy the unconscionable, but at that time common, practice of paying female employees less wages than male employees for the same job. The law banned compensating men and women unequally on the basis of sex for equal work on jobs the performance of which requires equal skill, effort, and responsibility under similar working conditions. The Civil Rights Act, passed just a year later, famously prohibited discrimination in hiring, firing, and other employment practices on the basis of sex, among other categories. Sex barely squeaked into the law, which had originally been written to bar discrimination on the basis of race, color, religion, or national origin. But as the bill was being debated by Congress, segregationist Democrat Representative Howard W. Smith of Virginia proposed adding the term sex to Title VII of the bill, reportedly as a poison pill to undermine its chances of passing. His proposal was met with laughs on the House floor. "I am serious," he said. "It is indisputable fact that all throughout history, women are discriminated against." Whatever his intent, sex made the final cut, and women were the better for it. The bill still passed, and with broad bipartisan support. The Civil Rights Act also created the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, which was tasked with, among other issues, fighting sex discrimination. Most notably, it created legal redress for women who were sexually harassed at work on the grounds that such harassment constituted a form of sex discrimination. And then there was Title IX of the Education Amendments of 1972. Title IX may be best known for effectively giving birth to girls' sports, but its greater significance lies in the educational opportunities it opened to women. The law prohibits sex-based discrimination in schools receiving federal funding from the preschool level upward and in programs and activities associated with those schools. As a result, many top universities and professional schools that had once capped the number of women they admitted or refused to admit them at all opened their doors to male and female applicants on an equal basis. Private colleges and single-sex public colleges were exempt from the requirement to admit both sexes, but by 1983, the formerly all-male Ivy League institutions had all gone co-ed amid a changing environment and mounting pressure to admit women. Following Title IX's enactment, women's enrollment in graduate and professional schools in particular skyrocketed. As one article on the law's legacy noted, in 1970, women earned only 14% of doctoral degrees. In 1971, just about one of 100 dental school graduates were women, while in 2005, that number grew nearly 40-fold. In medical schools, the numbers jumped from less than 10% to nearly 50%, and law school numbers from about 7% to nearly 49%. Fast forward to today, and at every level of education, women today are earning more degrees than men. No one's fault. But not everything that was billed as sexual equality under the law worked out so equally for the two sexes. Take, for example, no-fault divorce, one of the final fruits of the sexual revolution. Initially viewed as the female ticket to liberation from the confining institution of marriage, a comfortable concentration camp, according to Betty Friedan, and the model for slavery law in this country, as Gloria Steinem labeled it, the costs of no-fault divorce were disproportionately borne by women. In 1970, California became the first state to implement no-fault divorce, and most states quickly followed its lead. As the name suggests, under the new regime, couples did not have to prove that one spouse was at fault for the end of the marriage. Unsurprisingly, what followed was a notable spike in divorce rates. Although the divorce rate has since fallen somewhat, even in the new millennium, more than 4 in 10 couples marrying for the first time are expected to split. Divorce is terrible for women. Women are more likely than men to lose their health insurance after divorce, according to the University of Michigan, and twice as likely as men to fall into poverty. And no-fault divorce is even worse for women. In a no-fault divorce, only a third of women wind up keeping the family home, as opposed to more than 3/4 in a fault divorce. And even women who stay married are affected by no-fault divorce laws. A study at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School of Business found that people in states where unilateral no-fault divorce is permitted are less open to making financial sacrifices for their spouse's future. This and other female misfortunes, like the rise in single motherhood, have prompted some of the sexual revolution's icons to reconsider their position. "I think we made a mistake with no-fault divorce," Betty Friedan admitted, acknowledging that it had led to unintended consequences for women. In 2006, the then president of the New York chapter of the National Organization for Women wrote an article for the New York Times documenting the many ways that no-fault divorce hurts women in particular and pleading with state officials not to legalize it. They did anyway. The right to privacy. Other policy upheavals affected American families in similarly dramatic ways. In 1965, 5 years after the FDA's approval of the birth control pill jump-started the sexual revolution, the Supreme Court in Griswold v. Connecticut overturned the many state laws forbidding the provision of contraception to married couples. Today, laws against birth control sound quaint, but the court's rationale, that such laws violate Americans' right to privacy, a right implicit, the court said, within the First, Third, Fourth, and Ninth Amendments to the Constitution, set off a chain reaction of cases enshrining the notion that human sexuality was purely a matter of individual taste and recreation. By 1970, the federal government was actively promoting the use of contraception, particularly among low-income people, through Title X of the Public Health Service Act. Just 3 years later, in perhaps the most cataclysmic change of the era, the newfangled notion of a constitutional right to privacy was extended all the way to abortion. In Roe v. Wade, the Supreme Court struck down most state limits on abortion and guaranteed every woman the right to terminate a pregnancy. The work of the sexual revolution was complete. Women were now equal with men. They had shed what society had declared to be their bodily limitations, the ways in which their sexuality was different from men's. A few voices warned, however, that things were not that simple. One of the more prominent of these voices was Pope Paul VI's. He warned that the goals of the sexual revolution would backfire on the sex they purported to liberate, women. In 1968, he wrote, "A man who grows accustomed to the use of contraceptive methods may forget the reverence due to a woman and, disregarding her physical and emotional equilibrium, reduce her to being a mere instrument for the satisfaction of his own desires, no longer considering her as his partner whom he should surround with care and affection." The Pope's prognostications were widely dismissed at the time, but more than 40 years later, a 2012 article in Business Insider under the rather unorthodox headline, "Time to Admit It, the Church Has Always Been Right on Birth Control," went viral. The authors pointed out that, think what you like about the Pope, his predictions about what would happen if contraception became widely used, in chief, his warning about the reduction of women to objects used to satisfy men, were correct. If you click on the article today, it has a little red flame next to the date, signifying its popularity, with over 1 million hits and counting. The piece recounts the staggering social costs, not just of the pill, but of legal abortion and the many other sweeping changes of the sexual revolution. In short, as the economist George Akerlof and Fed Chair Janet Yellen once wrote in Slate, "By making the birth of the child the physical choice of the mother, the sexual revolution has made marriage and child support a social choice of the father." All this brings me back to the Tufts Quad, and the bright and beautiful young woman standing across from me with her head hung in humiliation. There was no way around it. She had been used as a sex object by a man, and he had walked away scot-free. The sex freakout of the 60s and 70s was supposed to de-scandalize sex and empower women. Instead, the inherent assumptions of the sexual revolution placed the scandal and its burdens squarely on their shoulders. Chapter 8. Disparate Impact. Why can't a woman be more like a man? Professor Higgins, My Fair Lady. It was Valentine's Day weekend in 2015, and millions of women across America were heading out on dates to see a newly released movie. But not a warm-hearted romance. It was a movie about torture sex, and it went on to be one of the biggest hits in cinema history. 50 Shades of Grey, adapted from E.L. James' hit tome, broke box office records as the highest-grossing movie to open on President's Day weekend and Universal Pictures' top-earning R-rated release ever. The movie's premise was simple and sexist. A bookish young aspiring journalist is seduced by a corporate tycoon who turns her into his pornographic plaything. He coaxes her into setting aside her reservations and becoming his sex slave in the twisted world of bondage and discipline, dominance and submission, sadism and masochism, BDSM. He is domineering and controlling, telling her, "I exercise control in all things, and I don't do romance." That didn't stop women from lining the block. The movie's opening weekend audience was 68% female. The smashing success of this BDSM-filled romance flick, as Cinema Blend called it, was the death knell for chivalry. One can draw a straight line back from the death of chivalry to the sexual revolution's second-wave feminists who demanded that women be treated exactly like men and slapped the sexist label on anyone who disagreed. Chivalry is dead. Emily Esfahani Smith opened a 2012 piece on chivalry for The Atlantic with a reference to the 100-year anniversary of the sinking of the Titanic, in which chivalry was on full display despite the panic of those on board. The vast majority of survivors were women. The overwhelming majority of those who perished were men. This was because chivalry taught men that women are owed preferential treatment, not just because we are the weaker sex, but because heroism and self-sacrifice are prized virtues in men. But the sexual revolution enshrined the notion that this preferential treatment, meant to correct for physical inequities, quell the male propensity toward violence, and tame men's often overwhelming sexual appetite, was little more than benevolent sexism. That's according to a study published in the feminist journal Psychology of Women Quarterly, whose claims Esfahani Smith summarized. The concept of chivalry is rooted in the gendered premise that women are weak and in need of protection while men are strong, and it perpetuates gender inequality. So what's a world without chivalry like? Women are now more than willing to go see a movie that glamorizes a man's violent sexual abuse of a woman. As one man explained in Elite Daily, in the hookup culture we now live in, it's pretty obvious that chivalry is completely dead. Dating is done. Seriously, who goes on dates anymore? It's all about hooking up, getting a number, grabbing a drink, and getting down. While maybe not a master of eloquence, he makes a good point. The real problem here is that women, for one reason or another, have become complacent and allowed men to get away with adhering to the bare minimum. Until women start asking for the things they deserve, he argues, men are going to get away with putting in the bare minimum and receiving what we ultimately want anyway, sex. It's pretty obvious that women own the cards, and when they start acting like it, they'll finally start getting dinner from places that don't deliver. Men and women are eating the leftovers of the sexual revolution. We are taught that there is no difference between the sexes, and that anyone who suggests otherwise is undermining women's equality with men. Advocates of chivalry are accused of infantilizing women, enforcing gender stereotypes that imply women are not capable of doing the same things as a man. Yet without chivalry, the worst masculine qualities run rampant, and women are expected to conform to them rather than demand that men conform to higher standards. Nothing exemplifies this more than the hookup culture. Although it's billed as liberation for women and their long-repressed sexual appetites, a way that women can enjoy sex while delaying marriage and children for the sake of their careers, women are the ones left feeling the negative consequences, whether it's sexually transmitted diseases that disproportionately affect women, unintended pregnancies, or just general anxiety. In the fallout of the hookup culture, in which women are encouraged to explore their sexual appetites like the most base teenage boy, dating is nearly dead. The headlines tell the story. Work It, Is Dating Worth the Effort? In The New Yorker. The End of Courtship, in The New York Times. Or All the Single Ladies, on the cover of The Atlantic, in which a 40-something single female journalist unconvincingly tries to persuade the next generation of women that we don't really need men after all. What dating does still exist often begins in the electronic world, where men typically filter women by their looks. One study of online dating trends found that the most attractive women received 83% of all inquiries from male suitors, potentially more if their inboxes had not filled up. A study on male versus female preferences in online dating revealed, for men, there is no amount of income that the woman in the bottom 10% in terms of appearance can earn to make men prefer her over women in the top percent. Cohabitation represents the ultimate male triumph in a non-chivalrous world. Men get all the goods of marriage without any of the commitment. Women, meanwhile, face all the same risks as they do in sexually active dating, with no insurance against their partners simply deciding to move on to the next willing and often younger domestic partner. Pregnancy is not a privileged class. But one needn't look into the bedroom to see what happens when society insists that men and women should be treated as if they are no different. A simple subway ride will do. Women who are 9 months pregnant can routinely be spotted struggling to stand in a crowded train while able-bodied men look on. This happened to me more times than I can count on the metro in Washington, D.C. Once, days away from my due date, I was carrying two bags and could hardly reach the ceiling handle. When someone asked the 8 able-bodied men sitting in the handicapped seats to give me a seat, they all refused. My story is far from atypical. One pregnant woman recently found herself riding on the floor of the London Tube after fellow passengers refused to give up their seats for her. Another was ticketed on the New York City subway after switching cars mid-ride in search of a seat. A quick Google search yields countless stories like these, including other stories of men who outright refused to give up their seats. Perhaps the most alarming about these articles is the comments they inspire. One commenter wondered why he or she should yield a seat to a pregnant woman. Because you chose to get pregnant? Give me a break. Yes, there is a need for more civility in society, but rampant entitlement for choices made needs to come down a few notches. Other commenters echoed that sentiment. Pregnant women aren't disabled, they made a choice. When women stop whining that they are owed because they are pregnant, then maybe people will give them a break. Everyone is sick and tired too. Deal with it. Everyone else who has to ride a train has to also deal with it. Pregnancy is not a privileged class, although they'd like us to think otherwise. But perhaps most illuminating were remarks along the lines of this comment, which takes us right back to the 1960s. If we, men and women, are equal, then why would a man give up his seat to a woman? And why would he pay for a date or ask her out at all, when he can just page her for some Netflix and chill? The problem with gender equity, which entails the denial of sexual difference, is that it shuts down chivalry, which is built on respect for sexual difference, and women wind up with the short end of the stick. It is sexual difference that activates chivalry, and women are its primary beneficiaries. Chivalry is not exploitative. It is the force designed to prevent men from exploiting women, particularly when they are most in need of different treatment. Without it, women are reduced to bodies to be used for male pleasure, then denied the most basic courtesy when their bodies reflect the ramifications of sex in a way wholly different from the bodies of men. Pregnancy is their choice, and they need to deal with it. Sounds like a raw deal to me. Sex in the modern marriage. The attempt to stamp out sex difference has affected marriage, too. It's no secret that marriage has evolved in radical ways over the past half century. Men and women meet romantic partners in different settings, value different traits in prospective spouses, and marry at significantly later ages than they did before the sexual revolution. And while marriage in the U.S. once featured relatively rigid gender roles, and especially before the 20th century gave husbands greater rights than wives, married couples today typically share responsibility for earning money, keeping up their home, and raising their children. Yet the extent to which men and women play the same roles in marriage is sometimes overstated, presumably because many contemporary scholars and journalists are ideologically committed to a version of gender equality in which men and women are effectively identical. Even today, married American parents typically split up paid and domestic work along gendered lines, because that's what most of them want to do. Consider, for example, how mothers and fathers spend their time. According to a Pew Research Center analysis of 2011 data from the American Time Use Survey, mothers of children under 18 devote, on average, 14 hours a week to childcare, whereas fathers devote 7 hours to it. Mothers spend 18 hours a week doing housework, while fathers spend 10. And fathers engage in paid work 37 hours a week, compared to 21 for women. In other words, fathers contribute roughly 2/3 of their household's hours of paid labor, and mothers shoulder roughly 2/3 of the housework and childcare, making their total weekly work hours essentially equal. Much has indeed changed since 1965, when mothers spent just 8 hours a week performing paid work, and fathers devoted a paltry 2.5 hours to the care of their children. But little has changed in the past 20 years. Not because inequality between the sexes persists in marriage today, as many would have you believe, but because sex difference is stubborn. Most Americans still don't desire a marriage in which both spouses work full-time and all other tasks are divided on a 50-50 basis. Despite unprecedented economic opportunities for women and equally unprecedented levels of domestic involvement among men, studies continue to find that we want different things out of marriage and family life. A 2012 poll by the Pew Research Center reveals that the majority, 53%, of married mothers say their ideal situation would be to work part-time. Other married mothers are as likely to prefer staying at home as they are to desire full-time work, 23% each. Fathers, in contrast, generally value full-time employment. 3/4 say a full-time schedule is ideal for them, while only 15% prefer part-time work, and 10% would like not to work at all. Of course, many, if not most mothers, even those with employed husbands, are not able to achieve their ideal. One 2000 survey showed that only 49% of married mothers with college degrees and 44% of those without college degrees were able to live out their labor force preference. Among those whose work schedule did not align with their ideal, more than 7 in 10 wanted to work less, not more. As feminist psychologist Eleanor Maccabee concluded in The Two Sexes, Growing Up Apart, Coming Together, even in a society that seeks to minimize the penalty women pay in the workplace for becoming parents, there is no reason to expect that men and women will want to make exactly the same choices about the way they invest their time. If dividing labor along gendered lines remains the societal norm and the average American couple's preference, might it also be linked to greater marital satisfaction and individual happiness? The scholarly literature does not provide a simple answer. As one 1998 study documented, the relationship between wives' employment and marital satisfaction has changed over the last 30 years. Wives' employment predicted lower marital quality in the 1960s, but not in subsequent decades, and by the 1980s, some studies suggested working women were happier in their marriages. Women's full-time employment may even be linked with lower divorce rates, according to another study, or only increase the risk of divorce when a marriage is already unhappy. A 2015 study using more recent survey data from 32 different countries, including the U.S., concluded that how couples with children divide paid and domestic work is unrelated to individuals' overall happiness in almost all regions of the world. On the other hand, a 2006 study using a large nationally representative sample of Americans found, to quote a press release, that women whose husbands earn the lion's share of income, who don't work outside the home, or who share a strong commitment to lifelong marriage with their husbands, report the highest levels of marital happiness. Perhaps the most natural way to make sense of these contradictory findings is a common sense hypothesis. Different couples prefer different work-family arrangements, so their happiness may depend more on whether they can fulfill their personal ideal than on the precise division of their labor. Researchers have marshaled some support for this theory. For example, in a 2013 analysis, W. Bradford Wilcox and Jeffrey Dew found that no one work-family strategy is linked to higher reports of marital happiness, that is, reporting that one is very happy in one's marriage among married mothers with children under 18. The fulfillment of individual preferences, however, mattered quite a bit. Wives who are working full-time or who are at home in violation of their preferences are, respectively, 46% less likely and 39% less likely to be very happy in their marriages compared to stay-at-home wives who prefer to be at home. Whether wives' preferences are fulfilled also affects their husband's satisfaction. An earlier study on the same topic arrived at similar conclusions. The effects of the division of labor on both spouses' marital satisfaction are largely explained by the mediating variables of perceived unfairness and perceived empathy, the researchers concluded. And personal preferences regarding the division of both domestic and paid work significantly influence marital satisfaction for both wives and husbands. The actual division of labor appears to matter less than dividing it the way a couple wants to, and that usually means the husband will take the lead in paid work and the wife in parenting and domestic labor. While the question of how traditional versus gender-neutral arrangements affect couples' happiness does not have one clear answer, the research is more straightforward on cases where traditional gender roles are reversed. When a husband works fewer hours or earns less money than his wife, as is the case for about 1 in 4 dual-earner married couples today, he is less happy and the marriage is more likely to dissolve. According to some studies, his wife's happiness also declines. In Wilcox and Dew's study, the only work-family arrangement that predicted the marital satisfaction of men with children was working less than their wives. Married fathers whose wives worked more than they did were 61% less likely to be very happy in their marriage than men whose wives stayed home. Even when the wives preferred this non-traditional arrangement, these husbands were less happy. Husbands whose wives worked more also showed a higher level of divorce proneness, a measure of how far into the process of considering or pursuing a divorce they had ventured, that has proven to predict divorce likelihood, than other men. Drawing on some of the same survey data, other researchers recently looked at how men's and women's relative incomes affected various aspects of relationships. They found that aversion to wives out-earning their husbands had widespread effects, impacting marriage formation, the wife's labor force participation, the wife's income conditional on working, marriage satisfaction, likelihood of divorce, and the division of home production. Couples in which the wife's income was higher than the husband's were 6 percentage points less likely to say their marriage was happy, and 6 percentage points more likely to have discussed separating in the past year. Other research has shown that in couples where women earn more money, and especially when they are the sole breadwinner, men are more likely but women are less likely to cheat. A 2013 study of Danish couples even suggested that a counter-traditional balance of income undermines men's sexual performance and causes anxiety in women. Studies of employment and job loss likewise show that marriages in which the husband is not employed are more likely to end in divorce. One longitudinal study published in 2011 showed that when married men are not working, both they and their wives become more likely to initiate divorce. The authors attributed this finding in part to expectations about what marriage should look like. Women's employment did not affect men's odds of seeking a divorce, and only made women more likely to seek divorce if they assessed their marriage negatively. A 2014 study incorporating recession-era data on job loss and focusing solely on involuntary displacement resulting from reduced business demand or firm closing, rather than terminations, indicated that job loss only produces a higher divorce risk if it is the husband rather than the wife who was displaced. Seemingly, in the minds of both men and women, holding down a job is a crucial part of a husband's role, while labor force participation remains optional for wives. Division of labor. The studies make clear that while there is no one-size-fits-all model that maximizes marital happiness for all couples, there are clear preferences that break down by sex. Ignoring those fault lines and exalting an androgynous vision of marriage undermines the supportive role that men clearly value and takes away the choice that women prize most. And yet our culture is obsessed with enforcing uniformity in labor and the household, rather than respecting the differing preferences of the sexes. There is an unending litany of scholarly articles seeking to address the gendered division of labor, and feminists continue to wring their hands about the fact that men and women spend their time differently. They are particularly aggrieved, despite the profoundly different roles men and women have in bringing children into the world, by the fact that, since the dawn of humanity, women have spent more time with their children than men, and still seem to want to. But this is not the only thing that differentiates the sexes when it comes to parenting. Even in our egalitarian society, men and women by and large treat their children in distinct ways that foster different and complementary strengths in them. One 2013 report summarizes the relevant research. In numerous studies, fathers are noted to be the more physical, playful, surprising, challenging, and risk-oriented parent. The father's style of interaction seems geared to push children out of the nest. By contrast, mothers seem to be the more verbal, affectionate, predictable, comforting, and protective parent. Their style of interaction seems geared to make children feel at home in the nest. Taken together, these two diverse parenting styles supply children with a varied parenting diet. These differences emerge as early as the infant and toddler years and are especially evident in how parents play with their children. Mothers generally use toys and games as they are intended to be used and often try to teach children through play. Fathers are more apt to use toys unpredictably and to tickle and roughhouse with their kids. Rather than tilting the playing field in their children's favor, fathers compete with them. Researchers are still working to devise ways to evaluate dads' interactions with kids, but the existing studies suggest that the roughhousing and risky exploration in which fathers specialize help children develop social skills down the road. We can also learn about the unique importance of fathers from the negative outcomes associated with their absence. In a recent review of rigorously designed studies on the causal effects of father absence, respected sociologists Sarah McClanahan, Laura Tack, and Daniel Schneider concluded that a father's absence puts his sons and daughters at greater risk of dropping out of high school, using drugs and alcohol, and showing poor social-emotional adjustment, among other negative outcomes. Other analyses show that a father's presence in the home, and especially a present father who has a good relationship with his children, lower teen boys' likelihood of